When you first enter the park, you're coming in through, there's a tunnel that I'm still trying to figure out, like, okay, is this like the, and I have to do some digging into this, but like, were these tunnels, was it just like, we've got, obviously this is the convenient place to blow up pieces of the mountain to find your way in, or was it like carefully planned where they're like, yo, you know, it'd be dope would be if you went through this tunnel and then you come out and the first thing you see is this. And they just, you know, very specifically arranged it in this particular way. Cause I mean, it's amazing. It's, it's a beautiful park. And, you know, my understanding is it's the origin of the national park system, you know, began with Yosemite and whatnot. And it's easy to see why and how, but I don't know. I can't even, I'm like trying to process it by like doing things like being like, I wonder how intentional this was. And it's just like, whatever. It was just majestic and amazing and awe inspiring in every way imaginable. And I was thrilled that my brilliant wife dragged us out there on a sort of like shoulder season. Because it felt, I mean, you could tell that this place is probably like traffic jams all summer long, like just through nonstop. The park and like, you know, trying to stand on your tiptoes to see the sights over the thousands of other hikers. While we were there, there were numerous moments where we would go like 1 or 2 hours without seeing another human being while there. And it was, and I felt like that was a privilege in and of itself. So
yeah,
it was like absolutely seeing it, lovely.
Yeah. Like kind of seeing it through the eyes of explorers, like truly. And also you had your kids out there too. And it's, I mean,
I was thrilled to see both of the kids were just in like, I want to crawl on rocks mode and, and whatnot. Yeah. Like to me, that was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was no app updates to be installed as far as the eye could see.
It really is that kind of like, oh, I can like see why like Manifest Destiny became a thing for people back in like the settler days where they were just like, oh, we need to claim all of this. No, like no one else can own this, no matter who they are, no matter what they do here. And it's, I mean, it's a gross mindset, but it also is a, I get it. After witnessing it, you're like, man, this really is on some like somebody put this here for us and we should have reverence for that.
Absolutely.
Make it like sacred. Ooh, speaking of sacred reverence, Johnny, we did have some F1. We did have some amazing,
some sweet sacred reverence.
Yeah. How are you? How are you feeling about this week's Grand Prix and this week's return to China?
So I'm gonna be honest. I'm a hot mess, Corey. Mm-hmm. I am jet lagged 6 ways from Sunday.
Perfect.
I can't even tell for sure if I've seen the Grand Prix or not because I watched it. Almost live at the beginning of a red eye flight from SFO to Newark.
It's perfect.
And I definitely fell off somewhere like 10 laps in. And then I tried rewatching the race like 3 separate times. While on my couch midday Sunday, but like all fading in and out of like, I just took a red eye with 2 children across the country sort of state. So I'm pretty sure I'm up to speed on it, but I also feel like it's all going to surprise me at the same time.
Yeah.
And
let's do the podcast. Let's get into it then.
Let's just jump right
into the deep end. Welcome to the F1 Files. This is our Formula One podcast. This is a podcast hosted by just a couple of best friends who have loved the sport forever. no matter what our mental state is, even when the whole lovely sport of F1 doesn't love us back. I'm one of the hosts. My name is Corey Willis. I'm a writer, actor, improviser out here in Los Angeles, California.
And this is John Lepore, creative consultant designing the future for film, technology, and automotive. All right, so Chinese Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
Exciting to be back in China. Excited to sort of like almost have, if you don't, you know, if you are maybe less worldly, mm-hmm. maybe perhaps like myself, the Chinese Grand Prix is almost an opportunity to be like, oh, let's check in with China and Chinese culture in general and yeah. just see what's yeah. happening over there in that wild corner of the world. Yeah. This was also our first sprint race mm-hmm. of the season. And I have a slightly clearer recollection of the sprint race
yes.
itself,
yes,
which was a whole thing in and of itself. Where do you want to start? How did you feel about this package of the Shanghai Grand Prix weekend as a whole?
I mean, I think it was good. I have a more definitive feel for this race weekend. First of all, it was jam-packed, and I am concerned that the sprint weekends are going to kind of introduce this fatigue that you start to feel towards the end of the season, even more so in the beginning of the season, especially because we now have a week off and then we go to Miami, which is another sprint weekend. So it's just like there's so much action that happens in these weekends yep. now that it is bordering on overwhelming, even for a dedicated fan like myself who had a weekend free and had no children to look after. Like, I really did try to take this on. And just because of the timing, I was kind of able to watch some of it in real time. And it was a lot, man. I was excited. I enjoyed the Grand Prix. But I did also kind of feel the fatigue of, like, do we really need this much action? First of all, we talked about how like the return to China was going to be a really interesting Grand Prix weekend because none of the modern cars had been on this surface before and it was a resurfaced track. Turns out it was like partially resurfaced and then partially, like, I'm going to do scare quotes, repainted, which is like there's like basically when you get your driveway sealed, it's like the same concept where they just yep. come in and like pour a more liquid a version of tarmac down to kind of like reintroduce this grip factor that this circuit hasn't had because they've only had local race series run on that. And it hasn't been that well used over the past literal 5 years. So there was an interesting like, oh, what's going to happen? Also, it's a sprint weekend. They're not going to have a lot of time to prepare. And I think we did see some of that. I thought we saw a little bit of disruption in the order, especially for the sprint and sprint qualifying. But then the race itself was a little bit more what we expected it to be, unfortunately. The safety car stuff was like interesting. I think there's some stuff to be talked about around that and that procedure and why it was so like needlessly complicated, I think, and also maybe a little dangerous at times. But I do think that it was an interesting weekend. I think it bore fruit. But it was also very chaotic and confusing for me too, John. I don't want you to feel like you were so in the, like, literally in the woods that it felt like, oh, I couldn't attach myself to this Grand Prix weekend. I watched the whole thing start to finish, including the practice sessions, and I was like, wait, what just happened?
Yeah,
I know Max won again, but what really happened?
It yeah. doesn't hurt that there's like safety cars nested inside of safety cars on some like Christopher Nolan Inception sort
yeah.
of stuff. cars trying to drive inside of each other and whatnot.
Yeah, literally, there was that moment, I think, like, one of the biggest, most interesting stories of the weekend was, unfortunately, centered around Lance Stroll and his shenanigans over the course of the Grand Prix in the safety car. The ending of
do you want to just start there? I feel like that's the most talked about thing coming out of this weekend is as you know, as we're getting into a safety car restart, the safety car is finishing up. Lance Stroll basically just like obliterates Daniel Ricciardo from behind, just like drives straight into the back of him, which is, I think, easy at a glance to just be like, well, that's a Bush League move from good old Lance Stroll. I'm not sure where Daniel Ricciardo landed like 48 hours later, but I know there was like multiple waves of him being like, yeah, you know, whatever, things happen. And then like Daniel Ricciardo being like, wait, he said it was my fault. He said I brake checked him. Yeah. All right, hold on. This guy's a total piece. And just like Daniel like going off on Lance Stroll, which is like, not something you see every day, right?
No, someone with as much media training as Daniel Ricciardo, quite literally being like, I think the nicest thing I can say in the moment is fuck that guy, I think was like,
yes, yep.
The poll quote, which is like, whoa, that is, you did just say that to F1 media during a Grand Prix about another driver. I think it comes down to, Lance Stroll is kind of looked at as, not kind of, he is looked at as like a Nepo baby. His dad owns the team. He's got Fernando Alonso, who he runs up against. His qualifying pace is disgusting compared to his teammate and where that car should be. So there are people who are like, Lance Stroll didn't really earn his seat and all this other stuff.
And I mean, don't forget, Lance Stroll also has kind of a funny voice.
He does.
Like, he kind of sounds like a Muppet, especially when he gets excited or angry.
Like a Muppet had like one of the greatest quotes that has ever been broadcast over F1 radio, over the FIA international broadcast.
Yeah, still, I'm still going to say that's radio comms of the year so far.
Yes.
From the previous race weekend where he just... Absolutely. He's like, it's from another category.
He was just such a pathetic radio communication. and then we see, like, this weekend, we see Fernando Alonso putting it on the front row repeatedly during qualifying and then getting bumped back to the second row, finishing in the top six or top seven in both over the course of both races. Like, he finished I think seventh in the Grand Prix, even though he made like a super late pit stop. But it was just this whole thing is like, Lance Stroll is kind of the target of a lot of ire in the paddock, and Danny Ricciardo was trying to be gentle, but then Lance Stroll was like, the guy just slammed on his brakes in front of me. Like, I don't know what else I was supposed to do. Everyone was like in a Constantina effect, which, real quick before we go into your side of this, Johnny, the Constantina effect is basically a slinky. We're talking about a slinky. When you have like a slinky that, like, you know, when waves move through a slinky, when you're doing the slinky thing, towards the end of it, it starts to get bunched up because there aren't that many spirals. It's the same thing that happens in an F1 race, where in a safety car restart, you've got the front car that determines the pace, and then it kind of slows down right before the restart. And when it slows down, all the cars, much like the end of a slinky, kind of bunch up. And it's on everyone's mind that this is going to happen. This is going to happen. So everyone is on high alert for this. And Lance Stroll was like looking at the apex of the exit of the corner when he should have been just looking at the car in front of him, which was Danny Ricciardo, who was like already standing on the brakes during a Constantina event. So,
yep.
that's the context of this. So what did you see, Johnny?
So, I mean, I caught all of that. Mm-hmm. I enjoy this sort of drama.
Yeah.
I do think it is also worth noting this sort of like the cars accordioning together.
Mm-hmm.
This was all in theory triggered by Verstappen leading the pack and doing his traditional safety car restart 100%. In like the most erratic way possible. And mm-hmm. it looked like there were actually several near misses from other drivers.
Yeah.
And I think it basically just comes down to like Lance Stroll was the person that was like reaching over to his cassette deck to flip the tape over from side A to side B while that moment was happening. And therefore he wasn't like as directly on the ball and, mm-hmm. and smashed directly into the back of Danny Ric. But it did look like this was a concertina effect that was like so dramatic. And I don't know if that has to do with the flow of the track or just that Verstappen is reaching the peak of his powers of generating chaos behind him.
Yeah. And in the cool down room, he admitted it was his fault. He fully saw, like, there's like a moment where they're all watching this event in the cool down room where it's him and Sergio and Lando, and like Max, like hand over his mouth, starts like giggling because he sees Stroll run into the back of Ricardo, and he goes, "Oh, yep. I think that was my fault." Like he fully like just in inner monologue.
Part of me was hoping that 19 cars would collide into each other, and then I could just, you know, park in the garage and go sim racing for the rest of the afternoon.
Exactly. But, and this was treat these restarts like sim race restarts. If you've ever watched any sim races or done any sim racing, this is what happens when like the drivers go like, well, there are no real consequences.
It's we're the just gamification game. Of
yeah.
Yeah. Of everything.
So,
I don't know where that puts me in regards to all of it. I feel bad for Danny Ric.
Yeah.
I almost feel bad for Lance Stroll, but I can't really feel bad for Lance Stroll.
And, I know. I'm torn. I'm of two minds here where I'm like, hey, Lance is there. He's not there totally on his own merit, but he is a very good, accomplished racing driver. He is. There's no denying that. Does he deserve to be in one of these seats? No. I think especially because we've got such an amazing, like, just look at Red Bull's junior team. There are literally five people trying to fight for four seats right now. And that's just the junior team. That's not even including Carlos Sainz, who was, like, spotted shaking hands with Christian Horner on the grid. Whom Helmut Marko was like, oh, yeah. No, we're fully in contract negotiations with Carlos Sainz. But Audi offered him an astronomical deal that we just, like, won't match. Like, we're unwilling to match that deal. So,
yeah,
we think Carlos is probably going to drive for Sauber. Which is just like,
we're now fully just negotiating in public.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's the new move is just, like, let's just, rather than tell the person mm-hmm. we're negotiating with how we feel, we could just tell the entire world.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then that becomes.
Let that be a new kind of underline under our statement that
exactly.
we're making.
Exactly. It like becomes a part of the negotiation process, right? Like that's part of like Carlos Sainz very publicly battling Charles Leclerc and Leclerc being like, he battles me harder than he's battling anybody else. What is going on? Like that was like Carlos and Charles came together at the end of the sprint, and that was the full on like FIA broadcasted radio transmission that went out to the televised broadcast where he was just like, I don't get it. He fights me. We gotta talk about this. So it's like there are public declarations during the negotiation process. It is just very peculiar to see the management side openly discussing it, right? I mean, Toto is also doing this right now with Max Verstappen and being like, we have to get Max Verstappen and Mercedes in the near future. It's a bit gross. It's a bit trashy, John.
Well, in a way, mm-hmm. it's almost as though the Andretti F1 team is already behaving like an F1 team by, like, you know, airing their dirty laundry out in public.
Yeah.
Sorry. What's your trash bait? What you got for me?
Oh, the trash bait is Christian Horner, baby. The trash bait is always Christian Horner. So this gross slimy mofo came out and did something that I actually admire a little bit and appreciate. He shot back at Toto Wolff, where Toto's been openly being like, hey, you know what?
Right.
Sometimes it's not all about like car performance. Sometimes like small-minded people think it's all about car performance, but like people who are big-brained think about like the overarching factors in contract negotiations. And Christian was like, hey, speaking of those overarching driver things, maybe you should focus on your team. Maybe focus on like making your team better and stop trying to steal my driver. Which, hey, I cannot stand Christian Horner, but I love the barbs that he and Toto throw at each other. I'm here for it. What are your thoughts there, Johnny?
No, I mean, that's the dynamic there is one that you almost sort of love to see, where you have mm-hmm. some person that you have one entity that can keep their cool and another entity that cannot keep their cool in any way, shape or form. And then, you know, entity one, all they have to do is just be chill with whatever information they say next. And they come out clobbering the person who's like super riled up. It's the, you know, it's like the same thing as the sort of like, oh, well, why don't you just fix your car instead of screaming about printouts, you know,
fix
your car, buddy.
Oh, as much as I despise Christian Horner, I mean, he's a terrible, terrible person who does awful, terrible things. But I do love that he has no problem shooting back at Toto, who is like also a person who has composed himself publicly very well and maybe privately has also composed himself very well. But I in no way like look at Toto is like, oh, he's this amazing person who's so wonderful. He's a finance guy who runs Mercedes. Like, he's not a good person. He is a fierce financial competitor and like a great team manager. That's all. He happens to be married to Susie Wolff, which like gives him a lot more good grace than I think he ever would have in this sport. If he was just Toto Wolff, the finance guy who came in as a shareholder, and was like, oh, right. I like cars. I think there's some trashiness that's being stirred up. I don't hate it. I will say that there's also some trashiness involved in like the way that. The way that like Hamilton is behaving right now is just like, it's so entertaining right now, but also I could see like it being so frustrating for dedicated Mercedes fans and people like Toto Wolff who are like, we want like Lewis being kind of miserable the way he's been the past couple of years in this car, in these interviews, but like every time Lewis is in front of a camera, he's like joking about how bad the car is. Like he literally is like,
yeah,
I don't know, it sucks. I made some bad choices.
I mean, and so that's the other thing is this weekend, it was very transparent that Hamilton was like, I don't know, let's just keep playing with all the dials, guys.
Yep.
One day it's good and one day it's off. And by the end of the weekend, he was like, yeah, Maybe I shouldn't be allowed to touch the dials. Maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which I mean, I kind of love that he's in this phase where he's just purely about like the car is bad. I'm going to try everything I can to find this silver bullet, even though everyone keeps telling me the silver bullet does not exist and I need to stop trying to chase it because it's like actually causing more harm than good. Like, I feel like that silver bullet's out there somewhere. It's like, well, Lewis, it clearly isn't, but okay. It's fun watching you go for it. It is fun.
Yeah, he's got like the world's most competent senioritis, you know? Like, yes. there's something going on there.
Yeah. The fact that he almost put it on poll. I mean, basically he did put it on poll for a brief moment for the sprint race in a car that is not good in bad conditions on a track that is extremely green on a track that everyone else is struggling at, including like the quote unquote rain master Max Verstappen. Like that. The fact that he's able to do what he can do at times shows that he is still so competent and so good at driving that car. So I don't know. I'm still pretty impressed, even though he's got some senioritis. You said it perfectly, John. He's the most competent person with senioritis on the grid right now, for sure.
So you did something bizarre and almost inverted reality in, you know, giving, I don't know if I'd even say a compliment, but a kudo to Christian Horner. I'm also going to give a compliment to Max Verstappen, who in all reality is genuinely deserving of many compliments after weekend. I just prefer to, you know, send general hate in his direction.
Yeah.
But I have to give him props because as he was in, you know, however far he was in the lead at the end of the race, I think it was like 15 seconds or something like that.
Yes.
He went around the final corner and like did a full on like power slide drift on the final quarter that was like twitchy and hairy enough that like if Lance Stroll was feeling hyper confident and attempted that, he would like literally like spin the car 8 times into the wall.
Yeah.
Instead of crossing the finish line, right?
Like, so I imagine that Lance Stroll would have somehow like done like some Tony Hawk esque, like Tony Hawk video game where he ended up like grinding the underside of the car on those like giant like archways that cover the straight. That was cool as hell. I was impressed by that for sure.
You know, it takes, you know, like literally that could have resulted in absolute disaster, but instead he's just having fun with it. So, you know, hey, if you're going to be that far ahead, sure, you might as well figure out a way to, you know, do some stunts along the way.
Yeah. He also did try to emulate his hero, who is Fernando Alonso. And I'm sure that he must have seen on like a video replay at some point, seeing like Alonso slide his car accidentally while trying to chase down Hamilton.
Alonso, he like dropped a wheel off the track, right? And went into like not like a cool drift, but like a full on like near tank slapper.
Yes.
Car pitches completely sideways and somehow Alonso gathered it up and kept the car moving along and made it look relatively effortless.
Yeah, like it is. I was watching Peter Windsor's breakdown of the race, and he was like, "Oh yeah,
Peter Windsor's breakdown of Fernando Alonso's underpants status." And he's like,
"Yeah,
here just you see, like, he's going browner than brown has ever browned before."
Yeah, yeah.
And yet a moment later, it's clean.
It was.
I don't understand.
If you have the opportunity to go back and look at Fernando Alonso's onboard while that happens, and I did this too, is like you like can't even see the camera doesn't register his hands and the wheel moving. Like, it is literally blurry on the camera. That's how quick the correction is that he makes in that final corner. And like, yeah, there can be like some disruption in the feed when those cars go around corners, but like the camera is working fine when he dips the wheel off. And like, that's the only part of the screen that is blurry, is his hands on the steering wheel. And it's just like, wow, that is truly, and that's the only part of his body that moves, is just his hands. Like, he doesn't even like kind of like turn his head to the right to be like, oh, that's where I'm supposed to be heading, or like, oh no, the wall's right there, I should like look to the left and make sure I'm like staying clear of it. Just
I'm watching it right now, and it is like this beautiful, like, I don't know, like, I feel like you have to make like, you have to be like a watchmaker to understand this precision of like, in a tenth of a second, I'm going to spin the hands of the clock to, you know, 3:17 and 2 seconds, and then immediately spin it back the other way to 10 p.m. flat, you know.
And he does just this like, while keeping his foot pinned on the accelerator.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he like takes his foot off the gas and does this. He does this going like, oh, I need to keep the wheels spinning in exactly the exact RPM that the right wheel is spinning and the exact RPM that the left rear wheel is spinning, because they are not spinning at the same rate per minute. Like, it is wild how precise that correction is. I'm flabbergasted by that. And it just shows like Fernando Alonso is, as much as it's like, oh yeah, he hasn't won a race in like almost 5,000 days or whatever.
He's not even finished with the, sorry, I'm watching this. He's finished, you know, getting back to neutral when he opens the DRS.
I know.
Like, he already is like being like, it's okay. Even though I haven't fully finished saving this disaster, I'm confident enough that I can relieve, you know, all the grip on the rear of the car where this disaster is unfolding by opening the DRS. I mean, it's wild.
I'm going to put one even further up the board than that, John. I'm going to say that he probably activated the DRS in order to normalize the wheel spin he was actually experiencing in the moment, because it relieves the downforce on the back of the car. And he was probably like, oh, I need to get the wheel spinning at the same rate. How do I do that? Oh, DRS. And like, did this all in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second. Like, it, I'm blown away. I'm truly blown away. And that's all we should, that's all that anyone should be talking about. Peter Windsor was like, this is why I watch F1 still, is for a moment like that, that I get to witness. I don't care about Max Verstappen's domination. He could win every race from here until the day he retires. If I get a moment like that once a season, I'm happy. And I agree. I'm like, if I could get that moment tattooed on my body, I would. Like, it's like, it's crazy.
I am loving this moment. And I just had to like take a deep dive back into the sort of like Skip Barber, you know, intro to racing textbook to make sure, cause it is all about when you have a sudden violent oversteer moment in any racing school, like the lesson that they give you is it's CPR.
Mm-hmm.
You correct.
Yep.
You pause and then you recover.
Yeah.
And I think what you're identifying is that his recovery, which could also like cause a tank slap need for another correction, right?
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
Perhaps that was it. Opening the DRS mid recovery was almost like a way of like making that a little more gentle, so that the car doesn't then just snap back violently the other way. I mean, masterclass.
Yeah. It really,
big Alonso weekend in general, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, that dude.
Strong throughout this. And sorry, you're going to have to help me with my time zones here. Mm-hmm. Sprint race was where he basically just went for it in the opening lap and made it stick. Or no, well, that was
the Grand Prix.
That was the Grand Prix, because it was Lando that mm-hmm. tried to make it stick in the sprint race. Yep. And Fernando did the same exact thing, basically just to be like, Lando, I'm going to do what you did yesterday, yeah. but I'm going to do it correctly.
Yes.
And it's because I'm older and wiser, and I'm not going to get overly excited. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to gently flirt with the limit of, you know, grip and tire adhesion.
Yeah.
Whereas you were aggressively flirting, Axe body spray flirting.
Exactly. Yeah.
You had no choice but to go off the edge of the track.
You were like Axe body spray as you're like closing a copy of the game and walking towards like a group of girls who are already dancing around like their purses in a circle. Like you're, it's like, buddy, no, stop doing what you're doing.
God. And what is in that bar lounge scenario, what is like Fernando's equivalent? Like, what is he doing that is, rather than reeking of aggressive desperation?
Fernando is the guy at the men's room when he sees that like the women's room is completely backed up, and he's the guy who's about to walk into the men's room at the club and like sees a line and sees like the one girl who's like clearly a little bleary eyed and needs like a moment to collect herself. And he like makes eye contact with her friends, not even her, makes eye contact with her friends. And he's like, come on, here you go. And he like lets them into the single stalled men's room and then stands outside the door and is like, nah, y'all can chill. There's business being taken care of in there and you need to be respectful. Like that's Fernando Alonso versus Lando Norris in the club.
Corey, you are my Fernando Alonso. That was amazing. That was absolutely incredible. Thank you for painting that picture for me. I am going to aspire to be the mm-hmm. fictional anecdote that you just created.
Oh yeah.
Although I'm sure you've lived that yourself.
I mean, many unfortunately,
times. You charming bastard. You.
I've spent too much time in clubs and worked in them. Not like the guy who goes to clubs, but the guy who works in clubs and keeps an eye out for people. Yes, I have maybe done some version of that, John. But yes, that is who I see Fernando Alonso as, and that is who I see Lando Norris as. Just not on the same level in any comparison, in any way to compare them. Other than they both have Mercedes engines in the backs of their cars. That's like the closest thing that they have in common. Speaking of the backs of McLarens, we had Oscar Piastri, who ended up getting serious damage in that Constantina shit show yep. that Lance Stroll put out there. So he bumped into Danny Ricciardo. Danny Ricciardo bumps into the back of Oscar Piastri and basically like destroys the left side of the diffuser on Oscar Piastri's car. This is just Oscar having bad luck. I mean, Danny Ricciardo, bad luck, sure. Yuki Tsunoda, really bad luck. Yes. But I got to say, Oscar Piastri, even when he has bad luck, he still ends up doing exceedingly well with like damage control. The fact that he ended up finishing, what did he end up finishing in the race? Was it eighth? So he still finished ahead of Hamilton, and Hamilton couldn't catch him, even though he had basically a car with just as much damage as Daniel Ricciardo had. Like, he was still able to navigate. Because it was basically the same thing that happened to Daniel Ricciardo. Lance Stroll bashed into the back of Daniel Ricciardo, destroyed the left-hand side of his diffuser. Daniel Ricciardo was lifted and tossed into the back of Piastri's car, damaged the same exact part of the diffuser because they were line astern. So, not almost the exact same, but very similar damage. And meanwhile, Piastri's able to hold off world champion driver Lewis Hamilton. Like, pretty impressive. Pretty impressive for Piastri. Terrible luck for him, but really impressive. Oh, there is something here, Johnny, conspiracy-wise. Can we dip back into the conspiracy corner?
Please, please, crack it open.
So, there is a proposal that is being discussed right now with opening up points-paying positions from the first 10 teams on the grid to 12 teams. Now, the conspiracy here for me, and I can't remember exactly where I heard this from, but this was mentioned by someone. The fact that they, and by they I mean the FIA, every year, they get an entry fee in the form of like a super license. And also, depending on how much the constructor has earned the previous year, they are then charged based on their points paying of the previous year. If you introduce more points, the FIA gets more money. So as much as I want to like say, yeah, it's cool that they're going to open up points paying positions to like 11th and 12th, you're really only just taking money from teams who are like further down the pylon on the Constructors' Championship too. So it's not even that they're taking money from the top teams. They're taking money from the midfield and like back of the grid teams, which I think is just like horrible and insidious and gross.
I can't figure out. I've been trying to make sense of like the math on that and trying to figure out, is this like, is this a good deal or is this some sort of like insane payday loan trickery to just get some teams to be like, ooh, that means there's a chance we'd get more prize money, you know, or get into prize money on some weekends, but then in other scenarios, probably get less prize money. Along the way, it also just kind of caught my eye that like the vote for this requires, I think, no more than six teams to approve this.
Yep.
As opposed to like all of these other things happening, particularly like Andretti wise and whatnot, that are like, no, must be a unanimous decision.
Yep. It is. It is some weird, like, this is, again, this is, every once in a while, we do get to touch on like the gross underbelly of the business side of F1. And I think that this is.
They're coming in and like changing the voting districts for this one, you know, like
exactly. Forcing like, and basically what they're saying to these teams like Williams, even like Alpine or Haas, or RB, and it doesn't really apply to RB because RB is part of the Red Bull family, so they kind of get like brought into that. And now that Sauber is being sponsored by Audi, it doesn't really apply to them either because like Audi is so accomplished and has so much money that they can now count themselves as a McLaren, count themselves as a Mercedes or a Ferrari or a Red Bull. So it's basically going to punish the bottom three teams in F1 by forcing them to pay out their constructor money at the end of the year. So it will look like they've made more money, but then they'll have to pay entry fees. And it just is like, it also is this like, again, the way that they're spreading the points, it's not going from like the first, the winner of the Grand Prix gets 25 points. And then the next, the person in second place gets 18 and 15 and 12 and 10 and 8 and 7. And then it starts to like get closer. They're going to start basically taking like those middle points and redistributing them. So it's still going to be 25 and 18 and 15. And then it goes to like 11 and 9 and 8 and then 7 and 6. So it like literally penalizes the teams that have like the best chance of making it out of like the back part of the grid. So it just is like, I hate it. I hate how disgusting it is. And I hate that the FIA thinks that they can just do this. And then when you pair it with like the idea of the Concord agreements where they're going to be like, nope, only 10 teams. It just like really puts the screws to those back three teams even more. I hate the business side of F1. I do realize it is a necessary evil to make the sport move forward, but it just feels so gross, especially when it's so out in the open like this.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. So, but that said, let's get back to the Grand Prix.
We've been zigzagging all over the weekend in general. Was there anything else that you were particularly excited about this weekend?
I really, really liked the way that they celebrated Zhou Guan Yu.
That was awesome to see.
Like, he's the first person to drive in Formula One. And I've seen a couple of people online be like, it's like a participation trophy just because he's there. He gets like his own spot on like the champions grid or whatever, because that's what they did at the end of the race. They usually have a spot for first, second, and third, and then they literally made a spot.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
I missed that entirely.
They made a spot like a little bit further back on the front straight with literally just a Joe, like his image and like his name, and he pulled his car up and got to walk in front of his grandstand, and literally like he like not collapsed but like squats down and like hands over his face because he's clearly starting to like cry because he's so excited about the support he's getting from his home crowd and like the meaningfulness of it. It's like, it was so beautiful, and I love this idea, and not just for Zhou Guan Yu, but this is like something that was kind of brought up again by like Peter Windsor, was like, hey, if we're gonna do all this weird pageantry, maybe we should do it in like with the concern of the person whose home race it is, or the people whose home race it is. We do this at Silverstone. We do this for every single British driver at Silverstone. They have these like elaborate media events.
Right.
But like, we don't even.
And I mean, this is also, I mean,
this stuff doesn't even happen in Italy. They don't even allow for extra like celebratory stuff for Ferrari when they're on the podium. So yeah.
Well, this is also a big part of like broadcast sports narrative, particularly when you think of, say, the Olympics, which I think is a perfect comparison given the international scope and nature. You know, now it's not formally done through the Olympic Committee, but if you are watching any broadcast anywhere in the world, they are going to make a point of telling stories about individuals in their, you know, home Olympics and whatnot. Yeah. And yeah, I think there's, you know, I do appreciate some of these sort of like regional flourishes that Formula One has been dabbling with. Like, I still am giddy with the mariachi version of the Formula One theme song for Mexico and things like that. Maybe less so about anything that they've tried so far with the Miami Grand Prix, which I think year one was like 10-gallon hats and like football jerseys and other
and police nonsense escorts.
And a perfectly orchestrated, you know, mass shooting event that happens, you know, just as like, see. Look, this is American
culture. Or like the LL Cool J last year. I mean, who knows what they're going to do this year.
They'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
One day they'll figure out something that celebrates the American angle of Formula One without it also being them, you know. Maybe the most American thing is for it to be them, you know, stepping on their own
I think so too. I was just
I guess that's it, Corey. The joke's on us.
Yeah,
that's,
it really is it. What is the culture here in the US? It is like basically like gaudiness capitalism.
Zero self-awareness.
Zero self-awareness or like marginalization of people who are already marginalized. Like those are like the themes that run throughout the US. So it's like, well, I guess if...
I think you can advance that even further to like some sort of like gross tokenization of, you know, and whatnot, and just trying to,
The insensitive mascot angle. It's like they're going to have like a dolphin caught in a net announcing the grid this year and be like, is that, I mean, it's not, it's still American culture. I don't know. It's bad.
And it's LL Cool J in the dolphin suit.
My head is like a dolphin's fin. He does like a
slightly
like is it's a little more curved. Head is like a shark's fin. Anyways, so yeah, I think I did appreciate the nod and the reverence for Zhou Guanyu being the first Chinese driver to drive in F1, let alone to drive drive consistently in F1 at all. I think there was another maybe reserve driver who is Chinese, but I don't think he ever actually got to drive a Grand Prix. But anyways, I think it's beautiful that they had that happen, and I would like to see more of that as we move throughout the calendar, especially since it's an ever expanding calendar. And the pageantry is there. It's already a circus. Like, let's just lean into the circus factor. So yeah, I think one other story that really caught me, caught my interest from the weekend was the fact that Carlos Sainz really does have a drive at Audi if he wants it. Like, if he wants it, he's got it. I don't want to see him necessarily at a backmarker team or even a midfield team. Like, he's one of the best drivers on the grid right now. And like it or not, he does deserve a spot at one of the top teams. I would really love to see him just take over Lance Stroll's spot, and then they just have like an all Spanish lineup at Aston Martin. Like, that would be pretty cool, in my opinion.
That would be lovely.
Yeah,
I think we both know it's far fetched.
Yeah, it's probably not going to happen.
I'd still like. I mean, I don't know. If I'm Carlos Sainz, I have to imagine that you put serious value in the notion of like, I could be in a winning Red Bull shaped object.
Yeah.
Or I could be, you know, filthy rich from Audi money. But like,
yeah,
going to Red Bull, you'd just be slightly less filthy rich. It's just weird, though, branding-wise, the connection to Audi, especially just because of his father and whatnot, seems particularly strong. And I don't know, Audi being probably the second or maybe first most mainstream automotive brand in F1 when they arrive.
Yeah.
Putting some serious marketing power behind Carlito, you know, helps his profile to some extent, but then like, doesn't that all just go to waste if you're in a car that's struggling to tread water?
Yeah.
You know, I, to me, the notion of an Audi, a full on Audi team in 2026 sounds exciting.
For sure.
But realistically, it's going to take them half a decade to like get up to speed.
Yep, it sure
if
is.
If they're destined for the best case scenario, if this is the beginning of a championship winning team, it still is by default. Like, you can't go from zero to championship team in less than 5 years, right?
No.
And at that point, we're looking at the end of Carlito's career anyways.
I was just going to say, like, he'll be in his mid-30s at that point, and there are going to be people like Kimi Antonelli on the grid. And who knows who else will be on the grid in five years.
Carlito's going to be, like, the last of the, like, old-school drivers who's, like, I don't have simulator RAM programmed into my skull.
Yeah.
What's going on with these kids who keep their gaming racing wheel zip tied around their wrist all weekend long?
Exactly.
You know, like, what is this new Ender's Game world of competitors that I'm up against?
Yeah.
And
also, I mean, he's there for the long haul. Look at his father. He comes from really good genes and really good, like, racing-based longevity genes. Like, he will be
continuing. Yeah, just a reminder, his dad just won the Paris to Dakar rally.
The hardest race on the planet.
Most, like, taxing, violent, dangerous, reckless thing you can do in motorsports, period.
And won it by, an astounding margin. Won it by, almost half a day, which is just like, whoa, what? Right? He won by, 6 hours or something like that. Like, it was phenomenal. So Carlos will be around for a while. I don't want to see him languishing with Audi in the midfield or maybe backfield for the next couple of years, especially if... I mean, he's been mentioned multiple times. He's the only person to beat Max Verstappen in the past almost 2 years. That's a pretty incredible thing be able to say.
Everybody, please.
Yeah. And as much as, like, John and I want to dismiss Max Verstappen, he is on pace to be the greatest of all time. Yes, Lewis is amazing. Yes, Schumacher is amazing. Max Verstappen, if he is as dominating as he is now for another 2 seasons, he will have eclipsed Lewis Hamilton's all-time winning record. He will have eclipsed Schumacher's. Like, he'll be the best in the sport if he just stays in for another 5 years. Guaranteed. So, we're not saying that Max Verstappen doesn't deserve the accolades or the flowers that he's getting or that he will get. We just don't like him. So, there's that. But I think that Carlos is incredibly competitive, and if you put him in the same machinery as Max Verstappen, I think he is just as capable of winning a championship next year as Max is next year when that car has kind of reached its development season or ceiling, rather, right? Because that's what we're looking at. I mean, Adrian Newey kind of already said that in that interview with Motorsport, where he's like, I mean, we're getting pretty close to the development ceiling of the RB20. And it's like, well, if Adrian Newey's saying that, then he doesn't mince words, and there's no ego involved with that. So we may see Carlos Sainz and Max Verstappen fighting for a championship next year if they're in the same car. And I would love to see that. As much as I want to see Lewis and Charles battling for that championship too, I'm okay with them not being competitive next year. I'm way more concerned with their competitiveness in 2026 than 2025. So we've kind of not really talked too much about the race this weekend. We mostly talked about, like, isolated incidents within it. How did you feel about the race as a whole, John? With a little bit of distance, with a little bit less jet lag.
I still honestly have made like no sense of the race. I was literally like, it took me until the end of a safety car period to realize that there was I was like, I don't understand. How is this happening? Why am I seeing replays of stuff that didn't even cause this safety car? And then I was like, oh, there was a safety car right before this safety car. Mm-hmm. Let me rewind and find it. And then being like, no, that's just the beginning of this safety car. No, wait, this is a different, what's going on? And then being like, oh, there's a safety car. And then immediately after the safety car, there was another safety car. Okay. This is my general malaise confusion around this race, Corey. Bring us home. What else was in there that that you think I should be cognizant of when I try to revisit it for the like fifth time?
I mean, truly, the thing that like stuck out to me over the whole weekend was the battle during the sprint race. At the tail end of the sprint race, I think it was like laps like 14 through whatever 20 or 18, where basically they had Fernando Alonso, Carlos Sainz, Sergio Perez, and Leclerc and Lando Norris, like all fighting for, in essence, for third place in the sprint race. So like the last few laps of the sprint race, just watching those cars battle it out, watching Sergio kind of capitalize on this battle between Fernando Alonso and Carlos Sainz, where Sainz got passed and then or Alonso got passed and then tried to pass Sainz again. And then they came into contact. That's where Alonso got his penalty from. And like he got like 3 points on his super license. So it's like a pretty big deal. Maybe a little bit harsh in my opinion, but also understandable. He caused an incident, and it was of his own volition. No one forced him to try to take that lunge down the inside on Carlos in the chicane. So I get it that happened, but I loved the action that took place during that battle. To me, that was like that plus the Alonso correction were really like the highlights of this whole weekend. Like really, really stuck out to me. And ultimately, okay, here's one more thing. The safety car. People are like, well, Sergio Perez needs to finish second no matter what. How can Lando Norris finish second above Sergio Perez? The only reason why Lando Norris ended up finishing above Sergio Perez is because he lucked out in that second safety car. It's the only reason. He was able to get a free pit stop and able to get far up the road. Like, he would have been battling for fourth or fifth place. He might have even been battling his own teammate and Lewis Hamilton for, like, the last point in that race. So, like, he really lucked out. I think Sergio, unfortunately, didn't get second place. And this is weird to say, like, a Red Bull, like, was further down the pylon than I wanted it to be, but like Sergio really did earn second place over the course of the whole weekend. Like he showed up and performed. And I think that's one of the biggest takeaways is Sergio Perez has kind of made it impossible for his replacement to happen at least in the middle of this season at this point. Like he's in qualifying, he's
yeah. It's looking like Perez is going to ride out the season for sure. I've been always speculating that he's like 48 hours away from an ejector seat at all times, but I think it feels like he's locked in for this season.
Yeah,
I think he's still going to get
discarded
unceremoniously
immediately
the second that the season is over, but
like maybe even before the end of the season, like maybe even like post summer break, he'll get announced. It'll be announced that like someone else is taking that seat, but I don't know. One more thing here, and this is something that like I want to see happen. I want to see the implication in a top seat next year. I want to see Liam Lawson. Liam Lawson has been guaranteed a seat next year. Now, if that is Daniel Ricciardo's seat at RB, sure. Okay. If that's Yuki's seat, I'm a little less okay with that because just Yuki's been doing really, really well and has proved himself repeatedly over multiple seasons. What I kind of want to see, John, and this was kind of brought up, I think, maybe by either Christian Horner or Helmut Marko, is the idea of, like, we have a Red Bull Junior driver program. We've loaned Alex Albon to Williams. Like, he's still a Red Bull driver, right? I would love to see Liam Lawson in that Mercedes seat next year to be a placeholder for Kimi Antonelli. So Kimi Antonelli can get up to speed and get in a good place to then compete against someone like George Russell, or maybe who knows what happens at the end of 2025. But I think that Liam Lawson in that Mercedes seat would be amazing. I mean, put him up against George. Give him a year to show.
I think that's some big brain strategy right there. And is like, you know, let's play with all the cards in the deck, Mercedes.
Yeah.
Really take ownership of Williams as a junior team.
Yeah.
And make those things happen. Like, yeah, start mapping out a more ambitious sort of destiny for the team at large. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Mm-hmm. So I don't work for Mercedes. So, I mean, I'm sure that someone at Mercedes has floated this idea and it's been shot down. But like, as a fan and as a fan of Liam Lawson as a racer, like, I want to see that dude in a top seat. I don't necessarily want to see him up against Verstappen. I wouldn't mind it. I wouldn't mind if he got slotted in ahead of everybody else, ahead of Daniel Ricciardo, ahead of Yuki Tsunoda. I wouldn't mind that. But I kind of would love to see him prove himself in that Mercedes. Because, yep, like, I don't want to see Carlos go to Mercedes. I don't want to see him. I don't want to see anybody else be a seat filler, really, for Kimi Antonelli. I could see Liam Lawson as a seat filler who just comes in and destroys George Russell and starts to like really be a reason why Mercedes is no longer a midfield team ahead of the regulation change. And then he gets to like put himself on the market and be like, all right, who wants me? I took a team that was not doing that well, that was saying they're in a rebuilding phase, and I made them competitive again, and I'm no longer racing with them. I'm part of the Red Bull family. Who wants me? Right. I don't know. I would love to see that. I would love to see it. But who knows? Who knows?
I like it. My only other takeaway before we wrap is, I mean, you know, I love the concept of the sprint format, mm-hmm, and playing with the format itself. Mm-hmm. I've got a new pitch. Ooh. For the sprint format.
Okay.
We pick a month of the calendar year and we say during that month, it's oops, all sprint races.
Okay.
It's just like, right, sorry, the scheduling software platform that we use malfunctioned, and we have no choice but for 1 month every weekend have nothing but, like, I don't know, two or three or maybe even four sprint races,
yeah,
a weekend,
yeah,
for 1 month. And we just pack them, like, we just pack them all in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my, like, that's my also, like, test run for, like, slowly turning Formula One, like, gently morphing Formula One more and more towards, like, Rollerball.
Yes.
or The Running Man.
Yes.
Or something.
Yes.
But it's just seeing, like, could this really work? Could this be? Because I don't know. I just feel like we've had some pure gold.
Yeah.
In some of these sprint races.
Yeah. Really? Really? What if we did this at like specific venues that have circuit, like alternate circuit layouts? Like if you look at like Paul Ricard, it has like, what, it's like 10 different layouts that they could do. And we only use one of them over the course of the weekend. Maybe we do like all sprints at Paul Ricard.
The format of the track changes every lap.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't know which way it's gonna change. Like there's literally like a traffic light that like lights up and tells them like, oh, this straightaway now has a chicane, uh-huh, in the middle of it, or a sharp left hairpin onto another part of the track that you've never even visited before. Yeah.
Oh God. All right. How about we wrap it up here? Any other takeaways? Any other thoughts on the sprint weekend in Shanghai?
Digging Shanghai. Excited to see it. I think particularly through Zhou Guanyu make a more like impactful return to the calendar. I don't know. This race seemed to be not feeling as distinct or significant in the pre-COVID years. And to me, this and, you know, seeing the fandom and seeing them connect with Zhou and everything, to me that like leveled up this race on that sort of like, you know, Olympic circuit of Formula One. And so for that, I'm thankful. And I think it's appropriate, you know, global representation here in Shanghai.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. I think that this race was a wonderful return. I think that all of, even though we didn't have as much of a chaotic weekend as we had kind of anticipated, as much of the sport had anticipated, not just us, but the actual people, the participants.
Oh, you did have that wet sprint qualifying, which we didn't even touch on, which was just pure bananas. Like that. And I attributed even a bit of that to like the track being refinished, not being properly bedded in and whatnot. And then you throw a little rain on that and it was just like, total
beautiful.
Chaos.
It was beautiful.
So that was a blast.
Yeah. I am a fan. Yeah. Real quick. The sprint qualifying format, as much as it was like, what's the big deal? I think this is maybe a little overwhelming. Maybe it's going to take some adjustment, but I think that this is the right format. I think that they may have dialed in the sprint format correctly to have free practice, then immediately sprint qualifying, then the sprint, then qualifying for the Grand Prix, and then the Grand Prix. I think that makes the weekend flow a lot better. I think it was a little tricky because it was in China, so it's on a different timetable as the rest of most of the traditional fandom is used to. Once we get onto the U.S. schedule, once we get onto the European schedule, I think people will complain less about the format. Because they won't have to wake up at 4 a.m. to watch sprint qualifying, where they're like, oh, is this qualifying for something that doesn't even matter? And it's like, well, it actually is, like you said, John, it was like the most exciting session of the weekend was sprint qualifying. Even though it was like maybe the most inconsequential, it still was the most engaging and exciting. And I think that's what we've been missing with sprints, is that they haven't felt consequential or engaging. So now that we've got something that is at least engaging, it can feel better when we're going like, it didn't really matter. Also, they've opened up Park Fermé so they can make changes. So you can have a Lewis Hamilton make wild setup changes that are unnecessary that just deflate his chances in the Grand Prix. So
he literally struts into the garage very briefly, presses every single button in the elevator, and then gets out and walks away before the elevator doors even close.
Yeah. Well, everyone's like going like, no, stop. No, please don't touch the, could you? No, not that one too. Ugh. All right.
Our careers are all on this elevator.
So yeah, I think this weekend provided a bunch of weirdness and a bunch of like uncertainty in places that we were not expecting, which made for a good weekend. So I'd like to see the sprint
100%
go forward with the way that it is going forward. Maybe we stagger the weekends, maybe we don't have back-to-backs. We'll see after Miami in a couple of weeks how people feel, but I think it's pretty good. I like this version of it better than any other version. We returned to a circuit that we haven't been to. We had the same winner, of course, but we had a lot of fun behind the winner, which is what we've kind of committed to focusing on this season, John, right? We've committed to focusing on the pack behind Red Bull and Verstappen specifically, but behind Red Bull.
So for you, Corey, does that mean stock has gone up?
I think so. I think the stock definitely went up. I mean, we've got Lando Norris winning his second place, and him even coming up and being like, hey, you know what? A second place behind Verstappen is very similar to a race win at this phase of F1. So he's not wrong. He drove a decidedly fantastic Grand Prix after driving a disastrous sprint race. So
yep,
he got driver of the day. I think the sport is on the up and up. I think that the sprint race proved entertaining. I think that the qualifying itself was entertaining. So I think that the stock is up. I genuinely do. And we have like a week or so to process this before we get into all that South Florida hype that we are guaranteed to get into. If it hasn't already started, it will begin within the next 48 to 72 hours. So we should enjoy this breathing room. What about you, Johnny? Where do you think the race is? Where do you think the sport is?
I think the stock crept upwards here. I think there was some fun action on track sprinkled through the weekend, even in some unexpected places, like sprint qualifying being, you know, an absolute madhouse. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's all good. I'm happy with it. And I think we're also like settling in to that sort of like blocking out of Verstappen. Yeah. And still continuing to appreciate what else is happening out here in the field.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you looked at the eclipse just right without the correct eye protection, maybe you've burnt out that part of your rods and cones that would register like Red Bull's colors or like that top spot on the pylon. Mm-hmm. And now you can like go like, oh, I can actually enjoy this. So hopefully you burned out your rods and cones appropriately during the eclipse and you can enjoy this season as much as we're enjoying it now.
I hope everyone's getting their personal optometry advice from the F1 files.
Yeah. I hope so.
Strongly recommend it.
All right. From two people who wear corrective eyewear, so where can the folks track you down out there in the world, Johnny?
You can find me anytime you want via my home base of johnnymotion.com. Corey, where can the folks find you, both of you?
You can find us on CoreyPWillis.com. And then you can also track me down on the socials, Burn Corey Burn, or the F1 Files on Twitter, on TikTok, and then the F1 Files podcast on Instagram. Folks, catch up with all four of us next week. Just like we'll catch up
with our blurry asses
next time on the F1 Files.